Okay, I'm pulling out of my driveway. We all know what that means. It's time for another drive to work. Okay, so the last two podcasts, I've been talking about cards from Zendikar. And I think I got up through K, so I'm not yet done. So one of the things I decided, by the way, is people seem to really enjoy the card stories. Zendikar is a very popular set, so I picked a lot of cards to talk about. This won't be as long as Theros, but I'm guessing this is going to be about four podcasts. Maybe five, but I'm going to try to get it done in four. So anyway, let's get on to L, Landbind Ritual. So Landbind Ritual is a sorcery. Costs three white and a white, and you gain two life per plane. So why do I bring this one up? Well, I bring up stuff when I remember things I want to talk about. So this was a cycle. There was a cycle of cards that were all in uncommon, and they all were spells that did something and counted the number of basic land you had. So let me talk about why we made this. And I think this got added in during development. I don't think we had it in design. One of the things design did do was we wanted to push a mono-colored agenda in that we had just followed Shards of Alara. Shards of Alara was very much about multicolor, and so we like to shift the pendulum, swing the pendulum, as you say. When I talk about a pendulum, by the way, I'm always talking about, like, you ever see hanging on a rope over a sand pit makes a fun design. That's the kind of pendulum I'm talking about. And that magic, metaphorically, is a pendulum, and that what we want to do is always push it in a different direction. And that the reason people play magic a long time. The average player plays over 9 years now. Why does someone play over 9 years? And that, by the way, for those that don't know games, that's insane. That's a long time. And the reason is I think magic keeps reinventing itself. You know, that at some time you might get bored of a normal game because you've done everything that you normally do and you just kind of get bored. But magic just keeps changing. And so the reason you don't get bored is, well, on some level, each year it's like a different game from the year before. You know, or every time a set comes out, it shifts. And so one of the things we're very conscious of when we're making blocks is saying, what did we do last block? Well, let's make sure we do something different. So last block was all about multicolor, you know, and this block was like, well, you know, not that we can't have some synergies with last block and not that you can't play more than one color, but you know what? We're going to give you some things that allow you to play monocolor, and we allow you to even draft monocolor. And so this uncommon cycle was something to kind of tempt you that says, okay, if you play monocolor, this is pretty strong, and it's probably going to float to you because unless there's two people playing the same monocolor deck, you'll get this card most likely because you'll value it way more than anybody else at the table. So anyway, this cycle was done as a way to help encourage that. There's a lot of other things we did to encourage it, but there was clearly a monocolor agenda at hand in the set. Next, Lava Ball Trap, another trap. So it costs six red and a red. It's an instant trap. If opponent has two lands enter the battlefield in one turn, you instead of paying six red-red, you can play three red-red. And then what it does is it destroys two lands, and it does four damage to all creatures. So the idea was, I've been talking all about all these different ways you can get lands into play. You know, all these different rampant growthing things. And so one of the things that's neat is we gave you a lot of tools to get multiple lands in play at one turn. That's something that the set enables you to do. Well, if we're going to do traps, part of what traps wanted to be, so I talked a little bit about the making of the traps last time, but I didn't talk philosophically about the making of traps. The goal for traps was, we wanted it to be something where your opponent did something a little out of the ordinary. It didn't want to be like, oh, you played a creature trapped. Well, you play creatures all the time, you know. And so we wanted to say to people, as you learn the traps, you're like, well, there's certain things you can do in this environment that could come back to haunt you. And one was playing two lands on a turn. Now, there's plenty of reasons to play two land on a turn, so people are encouraged to do so. And this trap is a rare thing. It's not something that shows up much. But it was a nice little tension that occasionally, when your opponent goes, ha-ha, I get my second land, you go, ha-ha, Lava Ball Trap. I also implied last time I talked about it that Lava Ball Trap, the traps were free. They're not free. There's a few ones that are free. What traps are is they're cheaper. A few of them are so cheap that they're free. But this one, for example, you save three mana. So instead of being eight mana, it's five mana. And there's a pretty big difference between five and eight mana. Because one of the things that happens is you don't acquire land at the same rate later in the game. Like, you draw seven cards opening up, and you have some number of land there, and you'll mulligan it to make sure you get some land. But then the later lands come at a rate much slower than that. So while you might play your first, second, third lands on your first, second, third turn, your eighth land is not happening on your eighth turn. And so there is a big gap between 5 and 8, more so than it would seem. In some ways, it's more than just 3 mana because it's many, many turns. And so if you catch your opponent unawares, you get to cast a spell much faster. Okay, next, Lorthos the Tidemaker. I'm very proud. This is my design. I'm very proud of Lorthos. So what happened was, I think we decided, I'm trying to remember how this happened, is I think we get notes from Creative about what legendary creatures there are. And so in the legendary, in the notes, they said, oh, there's a legendary octopus. Legendary octopus. Ding, 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 ding. I was very excited. So, in fact, I don't even know. It might have said, in fact, it might have said something like legendary sea monster. It could be a leviathan, a whale, or an octopus, something like that. And all I said is octopus. Ding, 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 ding. So I said legendary octopus. How often do you get a chance to make a legendary octopus? This was my chance. Okay, so of course he had to be an 8-8. He's an octopus. That was clear. And then I wanted him to have some octopus-themed ability. So the original ability I had was he came into play, and he just locked down 8 things, and as long as he was in play, they were locked down. That was a little too brutal. And so it changed into the attack trigger, which is now if he attacks, you can spend 8. And if you do, you lock down 8 things for the turn, and they don't untap next turn. So essentially, you can lock... If you use the 8 mana, and obviously he costs 8 mana. Of course, he costs 8 mana. He costs, I didn't say his stats. He's 5 blue for an 8-8 legendary octopus. Of course, he costs 8, and of course he's an 8-8. There's some aesthetics at hand here. And then he costs 8 when you attack, so you can lock things down. So essentially, the cost of getting him out every turn, you can permanently lock down 8 things. And I will say, usually locking out 8 things will swing the game your direction. But anyway, I was very happy with him, and he got received really well. I'm all for Magic being very serious, and I think that most of the time we treat the game with utmost serious. But it is fun to be a little goofy from time to time, so I had fun making a legendary octopus. I mean, I guess with a straight face he's an octopus, but anyway. Of my designs in the set, Lorthos is one of my favorites that I did. Next, Lotus Cobra, another card I did. Although, the interesting thing about this card is... it's what we call parallel design, where I designed this card going from one direction, and Graham Hopkins, who was on the design team, who came in third in the first Great Designer Search, and now works at Wizards. Graham came in third, by the way, didn't actually get a design internship, but ended up getting an R&D internship, because we liked him. And he ended up working in digital for a while, doing a lot of programming, and now he's back in R&D, still doing programming, but he's working in R&D, and he's one of my favorites. I love having him on design teams. He's really good. It is interesting to note, by the way, the Great Designer Search. So Alexis Jansen, Ken Nagel, Graham Hopkins, and Mark Globus all were in the very first Great Designer Search, as was Scott Van Essen, by the way, but we'll get him in a second. All 4 of them still work at Wizards. 3 of them work in R&D. Alexis does not. She works in digital. But she occasionally works on design teams, and she led the design for Dragon's Maze. And then in GDS2, we had Ethan Fleischer, Sean Main, Scott Van Essen, and John Laux, all of which work now in R&D. And so out of the 2 Great Designer Searches, there are 7 people who work in R&D and 8 who work in the company who came from Great Designer Search, all of which are still there, all of which do an amazing work. So anyway, I'm very, very happy with the Great Designer Search. We actually won an internal award called the Innie for Innovation that Hasbro gives away. So anyway, there will be a 3rd Great Designer Search, not right away. I don't have openings. I do not want to have a Great Designer Search until the person who wins the internship has the right to turn it into a full-time job if they work out. So it's not going to happen this year. I know the first one was, the second one was 4 years after the first one, and it's 4 years later. So if I was following that pattern, it would be this year, but it is not going to be this year. But we will do one eventually. I got to forget how much work it is. Okay, back to Lotus Cobra. So Lotus Cobra is 1 and a green. It's a 2/1 snake, and for landfall, it adds 1 mana of any color to your mana pool. So what happened was Graham and I both came at this from a very different direction. I think Graham... we had both made different landfall creatures, and anyway, it's an interesting story where sometimes people turn things in, and Graham had turned in a card, and I had a card, and they were really close, and so I morphed them into one card. But it's the kind of thing when people say, who designed what car? It's tricky. Because I could clearly with a straight face say, I designed this car. And Graham with a straight face could say, he designed this car. And the reality is we both did. And it kind of morphed into what was Lotus Cobra. Okay, so the controversy of Lotus Cobra, which I will talk about. So Lotus Cobra was a Mythic Rare. And there was a lot of controversy about Mythic Rare. Because most of the time our Mythic Rares are very grandiose. You know, they're legendary, they're planeswalkers, they're legendary creatures, or, you know, giant Timmy monsters. And this card was very efficient, but not big. And so there was a big question about what exactly should be Mythic Rare. And to be fair, this card, we spent more time debating on whether this card was supposed to be Rare or Mythic Rare than I care to probably admit, because we argued about it a long time. And finally what we decided was, and this is the thing that I've explained about Mythic Rare, is Mythic Rare has to have the potential for awesomeness. That you have to be able to see the card and just amazing things could happen. And the fact is, Lotus Cobra did allow some crazy shenanigans to happen. We decided to let it go into Mythic. It was very much on the border because it was a card that just really did enable very neat, cool things to happen. And we thought players would be excited, and we thought they would be excited as a Mythic Rare. We were, I don't know, part wrong in that. I mean, people did like it because the card ended to be very good, but we got a lot of grumbling about being Mythic Rare, and like, it's something we're constantly arguing about what exactly feels Mythic Rare. We want Mythic Rare to have a certain sense to it that when you see it, you go, ooh, that's a Mythic Rare. And Lotus Cobra definitely was on the cusp, and so I want you to know that it wasn't like without thought that it ended up in Mythic Rare. We did spend a lot of time on it, and there was a lot of arguing, and a lot of R&D members thought it should be Rare. I might have been among those. But anyway, okay, Mark of Mutiny. So Mark of Mutiny is a sorcery for 2 and a red. You get to steal a creature, untap and steal a creature. You get it until end of turn, and you put a +1/+1 counter on it. So this is basically a Threaten variant. Threaten is a red spell that you steal opponent's creature, untap, and attack. Threaten, and this ability long ago used to be in blue, and blue does it occasionally. But we decided when we were trying to have blue give some stuff up and give some stuff for red, that the idea of temporary stealing felt very red. That, like, you know, one of the things that red does is not only does it make emotional decisions, but it has magic that can inspire emotions in others. And so red is really good at making other creatures temporarily kind of act out. That, you know, it inflames their emotions, they do something in a moment of emotional overdrive, and they come to their senses, but, you know, for a moment, you manage to sort of get them to do what you want. Now, this card is interesting because the +1/+1 counter means I get to steal your card, I can hit you for a little bit more than I normally would, but then I give it back to you, and your creature is better. And I like it. It's an interesting tension. One of the things we worry about in design in general is how much tension do we want on cards? How much do we want to go, do I want to cast that? And this was interesting because the card was kind of neat. It did some cool stuff. Anyway, I like the card. I think you want some tension. You just gotta be careful how much tension. Next, the most controversial card in the set. What was it? What did it do? Mindless Null. 2B Zombie, 2/2. Was it a vanilla? No, it was not a vanilla. It had the following ability. Cannot block unless you control a vampire. So in Alpha, there's a card called, what was the card called in Alpha? Scathe Zombies, which was a 2B, 2/2 vanilla creature. This card is strictly worse. And when I say strictly worse, I in fact mean strictly worse. There is nothing about, excluding unsets that care about, like, letters and name, there is no difference between Scathe Zombies and this card. They're both zombies, they're even the same creature type. So Scathe Zombie, essentially this is a Scathe Zombie with downside. And people got really upset. They're like, because Scathe Zombie is not particularly a good card. That's why people got upset. They're like, really? You took a card that's not a good card and made it worse? Now, the funny thing was, in this environment, this card wasn't that bad. Especially if you were playing vampires, which was a very common thing to be doing in black. So this card got drafted and got played. And so one of my beliefs, what often happens is we will make a card. In fact, there's a very famous story. In Mirrodin, I made a card, I think it was called Malfunction, and it was you counter-target artifact. And so there exists a card called a null. In fact, if you actually see this at Mirrodin, a null got printed and not Malfunction. And a null is you counter-target artifact or enchantment. And so malfunction was just strictly worse than a null. A null could counter an artifact or an enchantment, and this card could only counter an artifact. But the thing was, it was an artifact set. It was good. You played it. Not only did you play it, if you were playing blue, you main decked it in limited. Of course you played it. And so my point is, here's a card that for sure you play. It's okay to make it. It does not matter that it's worse than other cards we've printed. In fact, and this is an important thing, Magic has a range of power level. We are going to make cards better and worse than other cards we've made. If we limit ourselves to only being better or worse than certain cards, then we start limiting what we can do. Especially if you make a card that we'll see play. For example, Mindless Null and Malfunction would have. If it's all play. People played it in limited. It was actually good enough to see play. People grumbled about it, but, you know, that it is okay to make slightly worse cards, especially if they see play. Especially if they're actually playable. And that, I know people get a little grumbly about it, but, you know, that is okay and acceptable, and that not every Magic card has to be, you know... In fact, here's one of the things that's important to understand, which is, it is not a bad thing to have cards that kind of are universally hated. You don't want tons of them, but it is kind of fun to... One of the ways to sort of bond players is to give them shared experiences. And it's okay every once in a while, the shared experiences, they get mad over the same card. Like I said, especially a card like this, where it's actually a playable card. Like, one of the things you got to learn with this card is to overcome your hate for it and go, oh, maybe I should draft it. Because people would say, I'm not playing that card, that's a horrible card. And then slowly they learn, like, oh, it's actually not that bad in a mono black deck, you know, in limited. So, anyway. Like I said, controversial. Next is Nissa Ravane. So 2GG, 2 green and green. She's a planeswalker. She started with 2 loyalty. She had 2+1. +1, search your library for Nissa's Chosen, which I'll explain in a second. Number 2, +1, gain 2 life for each elf you have on your battlefield, your elves. And -7, go get any number of elves out of your library, put them in play. Okay, Nissa's Chosen, by the way, since she's relevant to this card, is cost green and green for a 2/3. And when it died, instead of going to the graveyard, it goes to the bottom of your library. And that was made to play with this card. So this card... So there's a lot of stuff about Nissa. So Nissa started where we were making Duels of the Planeswalkers, and we wanted to have a cool image for the cover of the box. And so she ended up being... She was an elf, and she was a cute elf, and, you know, it seemed like a nice image. And so we said, oh, well, one day we got to make her. People seem to like her. We've got to make Nissa. And so when we were at Zendikar, we're like, oh, this seems like a good place. And so we made Nissa. Now the thought of... So this card is interesting as a planeswalker in that our planeswalkers are powerful, and this card is powerful, but it is niche-y. It's very, like... It is good in an elf deck. It's not good in any other deck. If your deck doesn't have a lot of elves, it is not good. We also did this thing where it tied in with a card. Where in order to play this card, you had to play this one particular... In order to play Nissa, you really needed to play this card in your deck. And the problem, for example, in Limited is... Imagine getting Nissa in your pool. You get a Mythic Rare... was she Mythic Rare? It was Mythic Rare, because obviously I just have a Lotus Cobra. You get a Mythic Rare, and then you didn't get the common you need to play the card. That's annoying. I like experimentation. I'm glad we played around with it. I don't ever begrudge us trying things. I think we learned that tying it to a card has some problems, especially in Limited. And I don't mind niche planeswalkers. Although it's interesting, we do market research both on the card and on the character, and that the character did better than the card. The card, because it only fit in a very specific deck, it wasn't as well thought of as a card that goes in lots of different decks. And so one of the things, I've hinted at this, when we recently released, Funko is making a series of dolls, there's 6 of them in the little, I forget what they call it, the little mini ones with the big heads, and one of them is Nissa Ravane. And people are like, Nissa Ravane? And I said on my blog, I said, yeah, we've got some plans for Nissa Ravane. I cannot tell you what those plans are, but we're going to see more of Nissa. We're going to do some changes. I don't want to ruin anything. There's some fun stuff coming with Nissa, and for fans of Nissa, Nissa's coming back. You'll have a chance to see Nissa, and she's going to feature into the story. So, I like Nissa. I think she's a cool character. And anyway, I should not say any more other than Nyssa fans, stay tuned. There is Nyssa goodness coming. Okay, next, Obnixilus. Ooh, talking about characters. So Obnixilus the Fallen. So trivia question, why is Obnixilus the Fallen? The Fallen what? Okay, well, if you look at a picture of him, or look at his creature type, he is a legendary demon, 3-3. So Obnixilus, Obnixilus did not start as, I believe he did not start as a demon, I believe he started as a human, who made a deal with the devil, or with a demon, and ended up becoming a demon, and then, why is he fallen? Because he was once a planeswalker, back in the day, and he, during the mending, I believe he lost his spark. And so that's why he's the Fallen. He's Obnixilus the Fallen. He was another popular character. So his ability was, he had a landfall ability. When land came into play, target player lost 3 life, and Obnixilus got 3 +1/+1 counters. So he started on the small side, but he quickly got bigger, and he was quite potent. He was no joke. He was a pretty pretty cool character. So and cool card. But anyway, And Obnixilus, by the way, has gotten quite the following. He's one of those characters that people seem to really like. So, go Obnixilus. Okay, next, Obsidian Fireheart. So it costs 1 red, 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 4 mana total. It's an elemental that's a 4-4. And then for 1 red and red, you may put a blaze counter on target land that does not have a blaze counter. And then what a blaze counter does is, during upkeep, it deals 1 damage to its controller. So during its controller's upkeep, it deals 1 damage. So what is the flavor exactly of this card? Well, the reminder text makes it crystal clear. Valan continues to burn after Obsidian Fireheart has left the battlefield. So you are lighting their land on fire. And this flavor, this reminder text has become very popular. 2 reasons. One is, I liked the fact that it did flavor work. Like, it's not often reminder text gets to do flavor work. Usually flavor text does flavor work, but we didn't have flavor text. It's too much space. And I like, personally, I mean, if you've seen me in the end set, I like us being a little more fast and loose with our reminder text and having some fun. I think this card does a good job of actually explaining what the card does in a way that's flavorful, that helps you understand why it works the way it does. It's like, well, the Fireheart lights things on fire. If he leaves, well, guess what? They're still on fire. So, next, Oracle of Moldiah. 3G, 3 in a green for an Elf Shaman, 2-2. It has 3 abilities. A, you can play an additional land. 2, you can play the top card of your library revealed. 3, you may pay lands off the top of your library. Okay, so this card is actually 3 different magic cards squished together. So first, it is Fast Bond. That's a card from Alpha that lets you play an additional land each turn. That was an enchantment for G that was mighty broken. Second is play top card of library revealed. I think the first card that did that was called Field of Dreams. It was an enchant world from Legends that made all players play with the top card of the library revealed. Although this one, just you play it revealed. And third, there was a card called Future Sight that allowed you to play... you played with the top card of your library revealed and lets you play cards off the top of your library. So the all 3 cards in the Time Spiral block were named after sets because it was a nostalgia block. So Time Spiral, Planar Chaos, and Future Sight were all magic cards. So anyway, little trivia there. And so this card lets you do Future Sight only for land. Future Sight lets you do any card. This does land. So it was a land-based set. It's actually a pretty good card. It got played. It saw lots of play. I was happy with it. It did neat things. The other cool thing about it was anytime, if you remember to not play your land, so you would draw your card and then got to see the top card, it allowed you a lot of time to help manipulate. And, you know, when you could, you played the land off the top of your library, so you got the extra card. So you got the extra card, you know, 40% of the time, whenever the land was there, you have 4% ratio of any top of your library being land. So, okay. So next we have Orin Reef Survivalist, 1 and a green human warrior ally. He was a 1/1, and when it or any ally came into play, he got a +1/+1 counter. So I talked about this last time. This is one of the fighters. I talked about the allies in the last podcast. That what he did is every time an ally came into play, himself or another ally, he got a +1/+1 counter. Because we wanted to tie the, make them all work the same, they all said whenever I or another ally come into play. So the +1/+1 counter was a little weird because that meant that we had to put a number in the lower right-hand corner that really didn't reflect what they were. This guy's a grizzly bear. He's 1G for 2-2. but it looks like it's a 1G for a 1-1. And so, while the experienced players got that he was a 2-2, it was a little hard for beginners. It made the card look worse. And one of the things that we spent a lot of time on, more than you probably want to know, is how much the impact of visually the card has. Meaning, when you see it, a lot of times, like the gods, for example, in Theros, we worded them in such a way that they got to be creatures, so you thought that they were creatures. Because when we worded them that they weren't creatures, it wasn't clear that they were, it was much, much less clear they were creatures. Also, you couldn't play them as commanders. They wanted to play as commanders. But we try very hard to make sure that we do such in such a way that it maximizes how they look. And this card, if it was made by itself, would come into play with a plus one counter. I'm sorry. Would not come into play with a plus one counter. It would just have an added stat. It would be a 2-2 and then only grant to other creatures. The only reason we didn't do that was whenever we're trying to make cards work the same, sometimes there's some cost to doing that. And one was, well, individually this card doesn't look as cool, but for ease of play, it works like every other card like it. And so that was important. Next, Pillarfield Ox. 3W, 2-4. Done. I bring this card up. It's a vanilla. I think this is the first time we ever did Pillarfield Ox. This card has shown up in more things you could possibly imagine. It's the ox that keeps on going. It's a nice, simple card, and one of the things that we've realized is, and part of New World Order is, you need to have simple cards that, you know, if every card is just doing lots of things, it gets overwhelming, and that there's a nice mental breather, even whether people are aware of it or not, that sometimes you draw a card and it's just vanilla, deep inside, maybe you're not even aware you do this, you let out a little sigh, like, oh, okay, for one turn, I don't have to process so hard this one turn. And I know people like to think that they just, you know, load it up, more complexity, more complexity, more complexity. But what I found was, and R&D found this, that when we implied New World Order, that the experienced players, the R&D, these are hardcore, most of them from the Pro Tour, were like, oh, it's nice to have a breather every once in a while, that, you know, having to think constantly is hard work, and that every once in a while, it's like, I know what this thing does. I play it, I attack with it, or block with it, I know what this thing does. Next, Plated Geopede. So, Aaron, from time to time, in organized play, we make these giant cards. We do this thing called Massive Magic at events where people, well, usually like Richard Garfield and I did this at the Worlds in Japan where we were playing with Scars of Mirrodin. I was Phyrexians and he was the Mirrodin. We'll do this thing where we play with these giant magic cards, and usually two celebrities, you know, pros or somebody, are playing, and then we get the audience to help, and each card is represented by a different audience member. And anyway, we can make these giant cards. We use them for organized play. So Aaron was making some to sort of decorate the pit, and it was around Zendikar, right after Zendikar. So he wanted to make a card to give to me, so he gave me Plated Geopede. And the reason he gave me Plated Geopede is I had done Zendikar was my set, and obviously the biggest part of it was Landfall. And he said, well, let me just give Mark an awesome Landfall card. So he gave me Plated Geopede, which is pretty cool. The funny thing about this card was that when I originally turned this card in, Henry Stern... So what happened was the first part of development was done by Henry Stern, and the second part was led by Devin Lowe. And when I first turned it in, Henry was in charge of the set. I turned this in as a cycle that all got +1/+1. And Henry felt that we could push it a little more, and he changed them to +2/+2. And that did push them. They were very, very good. Plated Geopede, especially, was probably the most constructed, although the white one, the cat, saw constructed. Most of them probably saw something constructed, but I think the red and white one were the strongest, or they went in the decks and most likely wanted to have the weenie strategies. So, anyway, this card, I mean, the one thing about Landfall that's interesting is Landfall ended up making a more aggressive environment than I had intended. When we made Landfall, our intent wasn't to make things fast. But cards like Plated Geopede really did push toward a very fast environment. And probably if you ask me my one regret about Zendikar, I don't have a lot of regrets about Zendikar because I'm really happy with how it came out, was I wish the limited environment had been a touch slower. I think we pushed things a little too much. And like I said, it was a combination not just of the design. I mean, I think Landfall pushed in that direction, but I think that we also were aggressive with it. And so, I wish Zendikar hadn't been quite as fast. It was a little too fast for my taste. Next, Punishing Fire. So Punishing Fire is an instant for one and a red. It's basically a shock. It does 2 damage to target creature player. But it's a little rider. Whenever the opponent gains life, you can pay 2 life to get it back. So this is a rare card. This is a Build Around Me card. It says, okay, well, actually, it's both a Build Around Me and a sideboard card. It's a sideboard card in that if I go up against a deck that has life gain, well, this is a nice sideboard card against that because it allows me to continually do damage to them, you know, and maybe I can offset a lot of life gain. If I'm building around it, I could go, oh, well, how can I make my opponent gain life in a way for me to get this back? And there are different ways, depending on the format you're playing, where sometimes you give your opponent life because you get a benefit for you giving them life. Sometimes you're giving everybody life. Anyway, there's different ways to build around. So it's a neat card in that it both is a sideboard card and is a build around me card, which I think is cool. And I like individual cards like this. I mean, this is a good example of a card that doesn't have a lot to do with the environment. I mean, there were things like the lands that gave you life when they came into play and this interacted with them. But more often than not, that really what I liked about this card, what I like in general is I like stuff making sense for the set it's in. I definitely want to make sure that all the cards that only make sense in this set get made. But it is fun to have just fun, cool, random cards that do neat things that aren't super tied. I think sometimes you can be careful about not making everything so tied that you don't have a chance for just fun things to happen. And I think Punishing Fire is one of those things. So, okay, I'm going to do one last card. I'm actually parked, but I'm going to do one last card because I'm going to finish off the peas. I'm in the peas. Although, actually, I'm over. Okay, maybe I'll have to save it for next time. So next time, I want to start with Pyromancer's Ascension. The reason I'm not going to do it now is it actually there's a lot to say about it. So I talked a little bit about the quest last time. So next time, I'm going to talk about some quests. So anyway, thank you for joining me for part 3 of Zendikar cards, or Zendikards, if you will. So as always, I very much love talking about magic, and especially talking about Zendikar. But even more, I like making magic. So I got to go. So I'll talk to you guys next time. Bye-bye.